Penguin Random House Audio presents Black Flags, The Rise of ISIS by Joby Warwick. Read for you by Sunil Malhotra. I bring the men who desire death as ardently as you desire life. Khalid ibn al-Walid, 7th century Islamic warrior, companion of Muhammad. Author's note. The names of several current and former Jordanian intelligence officers interviewed for this book have been altered by mutual agreement due to concerns about threats to their safety. They are referred to in these pages by their informal Arab kunya titles, rather than by traditional family names. Prologue. Amman, Jordan, February 3, 2015. Just after nightfall, a warrant arrived at the city's main women's prison for the execution of Sajida al-Rashawi. The instructions had come from King Abdullah II himself, then in Washington on a state visit, and were transmitted from his private plane to the royal court in Jordan's capital. A clerk relayed the message to the Interior Ministry and then to the prisons department, where it caused a stir. State executions are complicated affairs requiring many steps, yet the king's wishes were explicit. The woman would face the gallows before the sun rose the next day. The chief warden quickly made the trek to the cell where Rashawi had maintained a kind of self-imposed solitary confinement for close to a decade. The prisoner, 45 now and no longer thin, spent most of her days watching television or reading a paperback Quran, seeing no one, and keeping whatever thoughts she had under the greasy, prison-issued hijab she always wore. She was not a stupid woman, yet she seemed perpetually disconnected from whatever was going on around her. "When will I be going home?" she asked her government-appointed lawyer during rare meetings in the months after she was sentenced to death. Eventually, even those visits stopped. Now, when the warden sat her down to explain that she would die in the morning, Rashida nodded her assent, but said nothing. If she cried, or prayed, or cursed, no one in the prison heard a word of it. That she could face death was not a surprise to anyone. In 2006, a judge sentenced Rashawi to hang for her part in Jordan's worst-ever terrorist attack. 3 simultaneous hotel bombings that killed 60 people, most of them guests at a wedding party. She was the suicide bomber who lived, an odd, heavy-browed woman made to pose awkwardly before TV cameras, showing off the vest that had failed to explode. At one time, everyone in Amman knew her story, how this 35-year-old unmarried Iraqi had agreed to wed a stranger so they could become a man-and-wife suicide team. How she panicked and ran. How she had wandered around the city's northern suburbs in a taxi, lost, stopping passers-by for directions, still wearing streaks of blood on her clothes and shoes. But nearly 10 years had passed. The hotels had been rebuilt and renamed, and Rashawi had vanished inside Jordan's labyrinthine penal system. Within the Juwaida women's prison, she wore a kind of faded notoriety, like a valuable museum piece that no one looks at anymore. Some of the older hands in the state security service called her Zarqawi's woman, a mocking reference to the infamous Jordanian terrorist Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, who ordered the hotel bombings. The younger ones barely remembered her at all. Then, in the span of a month, everything changed. Zarqawi's followers, it turned out, had not forgotten Rashawi. The terrorists had rebranded themselves over the years and were now known in Jordan by the Arabic acronym Daesh. In English, ISIS. And in January 2015, ISIS asked to have Rashawi back. The demand for her release came in the middle of Jordan's worst domestic crisis in years. A Jordanian Air Force jet had crashed in Syria, and its young pilot had been captured alive by ISIS fighters. The group had broadcast photos of the frightened, nearly naked pilot being paraded around by grinning jihadists, some of them reaching out to embrace this great gift that Allah had dropped from the sky. From the palace to the security agencies, the king and his advisors steeled themselves for even more awful news. Either the pilot would be publicly butchered by ISIS, they feared, or the terrorists would demand a terrible price for his ransom. True to form, ISIS announced its decision in macabre fashion. Less than a week after the crash, the captured pilot's family received a call at home from the pilot's own cell phone. On the other end, a stranger, speaking in Iraqi-accented Arabic, issued the group's singular demand. "We want our sister, Sajida," the caller said. The same demand was repeated, along with several new ones, in a constantly shifting and mostly one-sided negotiation. All the requests had been routed to the headquarters of the Mukhbarat, Jordan's intelligence service, and all eventually landed on the desk of the imposing 47-year-old brigadier who ran the department's counterterrorism unit. Even in an agency notorious for its toughness, Abu Haytham stood apart, a man with a burly street fighter's physique and the personality of an anvil. He had battled ISIS in its many incarnations for years, and he had famously broken some of the group's top operatives in interrogation. Zarqawi himself had taken several turns in Abu Haytham's holding cell, and so had Sajida al-Rashawi, the woman ISIS was now seeking to free. Outside of Jordan, the demand made little sense. Rashawi had no value as a fighter or a leader, or even as a symbol. She was known to have participated in exactly one terrorist attack, and she had botched it. Hardly Zarqawi's woman. She had never even met the man who ordered the strike. If ISIS hadn't mentioned her name, she would likely have lived her remaining years quietly in prison, her execution indefinitely deferred for lack of any particular reason to carry it out. But Abu Haytham understood. By invoking Rashawi's name, the terrorists were reaching back to the group's beginnings, back to a time before there was an ISIS or a civil war in Syria, before the meltdown in Iraq that gave rise to the movement, even before the world had heard of a terrorist called Zarqawi. The Mukhbarat's men had tried to keep this terrorist group from gaining a foothold. They had failed, sometimes through their own mistakes, more often because of the miscalculations of others. Now, Zarqawi's jihadist movement had become a self-declared state, with territorial claims on two of Jordan's borders. And Rashawi, the failed bomber, was one of many old scores that ISIS was ready to settle. In summoning this forgotten ghost, ISIS was evoking one of the most horrifying nights in the country's history, a moment seared into the memories of men of Abu Haytham's generation, the former intelligence captains, investigators, and deputies who had since risen to lead the Mukhbarat. Once, Zarqawi had managed to strike directly at Jordan's heart, and now, with the country's pilot in their hands, ISIS was about to do it again. Abu Haytham had been present that night. He could remember every detail of the crime for which Rashawi had been convicted and sentenced to hang. He could remember how the night had felt, the smell of blood and smoke, and the wailing of the injured. Mostly, he remembered the two girls. They were cousins, ages 9 and 14, and he knew their names, Lina and Riham. Local girls from Amman, out for a wedding party. They were both dressed in white, with small faces that were lovely and pale and perfectly serene. Just like angels, he had thought. They still wore the nearly identical lacy dresses their parents had bought for the party, and stylish shoes for dancing. Almost miraculously, from the neck up, neither had suffered a scratch. When Abu Haytham first saw them, lying side by side on a board in those chaotic first moments at the hospital, he had wondered if they were sleeping. Injured, perhaps, but sedated and sleeping. "Please, let them be sleeping," he had prayed. But then he saw the terrible holes the shrapnel had made. The girls would have been standing when it happened, as everyone was, whooping and clapping as the bride and groom prepared to make their entrance in the ballroom at Amman's Radisson Hotel, which was lit up like a desert carnival on a cool mid-November evening. The newlyweds' fathers, all big grins and rented tuxedos, had taken their places on the podium, and the Arabic band's bleeding woodwinds and throbbing drums had risen to a roar so loud that the hotel clerks in the lobby had to shout to be heard. The party was just reaching its gloriously noisy, sweaty, exuberant peak. No one appeared to have noticed two figures in dark coats who shuffled awkwardly near the doorway and then squeezed between the rows of cheering wedding guests toward the front of the ballroom. There was a blinding flash, and then a sensation of everything falling, the ceiling, the walls, the floor. The shockwave knocked guests out of their beds on the hotel's upper floors and blew out thick plate glass doors in the lobby. A thunderclap, then silence, then screams. Only one of the bombs had gone off, but it cut through the ballroom like a swarm of flying razors. Hundreds of steel ball bearings, carefully and densely packed around the bomb's core, sliced through wedding decorations, food trays, and upholstery. They splintered wooden tables and shattered marble tiles. They tore through evening gowns and fancy clutches, through suit jackets and crisp shirts, and through white, frilly dresses of the kind young girls wear to formal parties. Abu Haytham, then a captain, was winding down another in a string of long shifts on that Wednesday in early November 2005. It was just before 9 p.m. when the first call came in about an explosion of some kind at the Grand Hyatt across town. The early speculation was that a gas canister was to blame, but then came word of a second blast at the Days Inn Hotel, and then a third, reportedly far worse than the others, at the Radisson. Abu Haytham knew the place well. It was an Amman landmark, glitzy by Jordanian standards, perched on a hill and easily visible from most of the town, including from his own office building nearly 2 miles away. He raced to the hotel and pushed his way inside, past the rescue workers, the wailing survivors, and the recovered corpses that had been hauled out on luggage carts and deposited on the driveway. In the ballroom, through a haze of smoke and emergency lights, he could see more bodies. Some were sprawled haphazardly, as though flung by a giant. Others were missing limbs. On the smashed podium lay two crumpled forms in tuxedos. The fathers of both the bride and the groom had been near the bomber and died instantly. Abu Haytham assembled teams that worked the three blast sites through the night, gathering whatever remnants they could find of the explosive devices, along with chunks of flesh that constituted the remains of three bombers. Only later, at the hospital, standing over a wooden slab in a makeshift morgue, was he overwhelmed by the horror of the evening. The broken bodies, the scores of wounded, the smell of blood and smoke. The girls, Lena and Riham, lying still in their torn white dresses. Abu Haytham, a doting father, had girls the same age. "How," he said aloud, "does someone with a human heart do a thing like this?" Just 2 days later came the news that one of the attackers, a woman, had survived and fled. A day after that, Sajida al-Rashawi sat in a chair in front of him. She would surely know something, tied as she was to such an obviously important and well-planned mission. Where would the terrorists strike next? What plans were unfolding, perhaps at this very hour?
I don't know. I don't know,
the woman would occasionally manage in a soft mumble. She repeated the line slowly, as though drugged. Abu Haytham pleaded with her. He threatened. He appealed to her conscience, to religion, to Allah. Hours passed, crucial hours, he feared.
How brainwashed you are, he shouted at one point. Why do you protect the people who put you up to this?
The woman would never offer a useful syllable, then or in the months to come, after she was convicted and sentenced to die. Yet already, Abu Haytham knew who was behind the act. All the Mukhbarat's men knew. Even before the culprit boasted of his responsibility in an audio recording made in his own voice. The signatures were all there. The coordinated blasts, all within 10 minutes. The deployment of human bombers, each skillfully fitted with a device consisting of military-grade RDX explosive and enough loose metal to ensure maximum carnage. Most telling of all was the choice of targets. Ordinary hotels where, on any given evening, Amman's middle class would pack a rented ballroom in their finest apparel to celebrate a union or mark a milestone. No intelligence operative or general was likely to pass through the lobby of the Radisson at 9 p.m. on a weekday night. But scores of Jordanians would be there, clinging to the rituals of normal life in a country bordering a war zone. Such hallmarks, like the voice of the audio recording, unmistakably belonged to Zarqawi, a man the Mukhbarat knew exceptionally well. He was, at the time of the bombing, the head of a particularly vicious terrorist network called Al-Qaeda in Iraq. But the Jordanians had known him back in the days when he was Ahmad the Hoodlum, a high school dropout with a reputation as a heavy drinker and a brawler. They had watched him wander off to Afghanistan in the late 1980s to fight the communists, then return as a battle-hardened religious fanatic. After a first try at terrorism, he had vanished into one of Jordan's darkest prisons. This time, he emerged as a battle-hardened religious fanatic, who also happened to excel as a leader of men. Abu Haytham had been among those who tried to alter Zarqawi's path after prison. He had been the last intelligence officer to meet with him in 1999, before Zarqawi was granted permission to leave the country for good, headed again to Afghanistan and a future that surely, so the Jordanians thought, offered nothing more than futility and a dusty grave. Then, in the most improbable of events, America intervened. Few beyond the intelligence service had heard of Zarqawi when Washington made him a terrorist superstar, declaring to the world in 2003 that this obscure Jordanian was the link between Iraq's dictatorship and the plotters behind the September 11, 2001 terrorist attacks. The claim was wrong. Yet, weeks later, when U.S. troops invaded Iraq, the newly famous and well-funded terrorist gained a battleground and a cause, and soon thousands of followers. Over 3 tumultuous years, he intentionally pushed Iraq to the brink of sectarian war by unleashing wave after wave of savage attacks on Shiite civilians in their mosques, bazaars, and schools. He horrified millions with a new form of highly intimate terrorism, the beheading of individual hostages, captured on video and sent around the world, using the Internet's new power to broadcast directly into people's homes. Along the way, he lashed out violently at his native Jordan and helped transform America's lightning victory in Iraq into the costliest U.S. military campaign since Vietnam. Yet his most significant accomplishment was not apparent until years later. Though some would cast his movement as an Al-Qaeda offshoot, Zarqawi was no one's acolyte. His brand of jihadism was utterly, brutally original. Osama bin Laden had sought to liberate Muslim nations gradually from corrupting Western influences so they could someday unify as a single Islamic theocracy or caliphate. Zarqawi, by contrast, insisted that he would create his caliphate immediately, right now. He would seek to usher in God's kingdom on earth through acts of unthinkable savagery, believing, correctly, that theatrical displays of extreme violence would attract the most hardened jihadists to his cause and frighten everyone else into submission. His strategy shook the region as Al-Qaeda never had. But Zarqawi's excesses also deepened his adversary's resolve. In the immediate aftermath of the hotel bombings, Abu Haytham and other Mukhbarat officers had a simple goal: to eliminate the man who had ordered them. And when they succeeded, in 2006, by providing the United States with intelligence that helped it track Zarqawi to his hideout, the terrorist and his organization appeared finished. Instead, his followers merely retreated, quietly gaining strength in Syria's lawless provinces, until they burst into view in 2013, not as a terrorist group, but as an army. This time, war-weary America would refuse to help until it was too late. There would be no serious effort to arm the moderate rebels who sought to deny ISIS its safe haven, and no airstrikes to harry ISIS's leadership and supply lines. Twice in a decade, a jihadist wave had threatened to engulf the region. Twice, it seemed to the Jordanians, the American response had been to cut a fresh hole in the lifeboat. Zarqawi's successors called themselves by different names before settling on ISIS, or simply the Islamic State. But they continued to refer to Zarqawi as the Mujahid Sheikh, acknowledging the founder who had the audacity to believe he could redraw the maps of the Middle East. And, like Zarqawi, they believed their conquests would not end there. In the prophetic passages of the Muslim holy texts known as the Hadith, Zarqawi saw his fate foretold. He and his men were the black-clad soldiers of whom the ancient scholars had written. "The black flags will come from the east, led by mighty men with long hair and beards, their surnames taken from their hometowns." These conquerors would not merely reclaim the ancient Muslim lands. They also would be the instigators of the final cataclysmic struggle ending in the destruction of the West's great armies in northern Syria. "The spark has been lit here in Iraq," Zarqawi preached, "and its heat will continue to intensify until it burns the Crusader armies in Dabiq." The Mukhbarat men had heard enough of such talk from Zarqawi back when he was their prisoner. Now the brazen claims were coming from his offspring. 30,000 strong, they were waiting just across the border, calling for their sister, Sajida. The charade of a prisoner swap ended abruptly on February 3, 2015, the day after Jordan's king arrived in Washington for the official visit. For Abdullah II, it was the latest in a series of exhausting journeys in which he repeated the same appeal for help. His tiny country was struggling with two burdens imposed from abroad: a human tide of refugees from Syria, some 600,000 so far, and the cost of participating in the allied Western Arab military campaign against ISIS. The trip was not going particularly well. Members of Congress offered sympathy, but not much more. White House officials recited the usual pledges to bolster Jordan's defenses and struggling economy. But the kind of assistance Abdullah most desperately needed was nowhere in the offing. The king's disappointment had long since hardened into resentment. During previous visits, President Obama had declined Jordan's request for laser-guided munitions and other advanced hardware that could take out ISIS's trucks and tanks. On this trip, there was no firm commitment even for a meeting between the two leaders. Abdullah was in the capital, making a pitch to Senator John McCain, the Republican senator and chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee, when one of the king's aides interrupted him. The monarch stepped into the corridor and, on the small screen of a smartphone, watched ISIS deliver its final statement on the proposed prisoner swap. As video cameras rolled, masked jihadists marched the young Jordanian pilot into a small metal cage that had been doused with fuel. Then they lit a fire and filmed as the airman was burned alive. By the time Abdullah returned to the meeting, McCain's aides had seen the video as well. The monarch kept his composure, but McCain could see he was badly shaken. "Can we do anything more for you?" McCain asked. "I'm not getting support from your side," Abdullah finally said. "I'm still getting only gravity bombs, and we're not even getting resupplied with those. Meanwhile, we're flying 200% more missions than all the other coalition members combined, apart from the United States." The king continued with his scheduled meetings, but he had already made up his mind to return home. He was making arrangements when the White House phoned to offer 15 minutes with the president. Abdullah accepted. Inside the Oval Office, Obama offered condolences to the pilot's family and thanked the king for Jordan's contributions to the military campaign against ISIS. "The administration was doing all it could to be supportive," the president assured the monarch. "No, sir, you are not," Abdullah said firmly. He rattled off a list of weapons and supplies he needed. "I've got 3 days' worth of bombs left," he said, according to an official present during the exchange. "When I get home, I'm going to war, and I'm going to use every bomb I've got until they're gone." There was one other item of business to attend to before his return. From the airport, Abdullah called his aides in Amman to start the process of carrying out a pair of executions. On Jordan's death row, there were two inmates who had been convicted of committing murderous acts on orders from Zarqawi. One was an Iraqi man who had been a mid-level operative in Zarqawi's Iraqi insurgency. The other was Sajida al-Rishawi. Both should be put to death without further delay. The king foresaw that Western governments would protest the executions as acts of vengeance, even though both inmates had been convicted and sentenced long ago as part of normal court proceedings. But he would not be deterred. As far as he was concerned, the appointment with the hangman had already been delayed too long, he told aides. "I don't want to hear a word from anyone," Abdullah said. The king was still airborne at 2 a.m., Amman time, when the guards arrived to collect Sajida al-Rishawi from her cell. She had declined the customary final meal and ritual bath with which devout Muslims cleanse the physical body in preparation for the afterlife. She donned the red uniform worn exclusively by condemned prisoners on the day of execution, along with the usual hijab for covering her head and face. She was escorted outside the prison to a waiting van with a military escort for the drive to Swaqa, Jordan's largest prison, on a desert hill about 60 miles south of the capital. The vehicles arrived just before 4 a.m. as a full moon, visible through a light haze, was dipping toward the southwestern horizon. Her last earthly view, before she was blindfolded, was of a small execution chamber with white walls and a row of tiny windows, and a few tired faces looking up from the witness gallery just below her. An imam prayed as a noose with a heavy metal clasp was secured and a judge asked if Rashawi cared to convey any last wishes or a final will. She gave no reply. She likewise made no audible sound as the gallows trap opened and she plunged hard into the darkness. It was 5:05 a.m., nearly 90 minutes before sunrise, when the prison doctor checked for a pulse. Zarqawi's woman was dead. Her execution, the closing scene, and the worst act of terrorism in Jordan's history. But Zarqawi's children were pursuing the founder's far grander ambitions. The end of Jordan and its king. The erasing of international boundaries. And the destruction of the modern states of the Middle East. Then, with black flags raised above Muslim capitals from the Levant to the Persian Gulf, they could begin the great apocalyptic showdown with the West. Book 1. The Rise of Zarqawi. Chapter 1. What kind of person can command with only his eyes? The most notorious of Jordan's prisons is the old fortress of Al-Jafar, known for decades as the place where troublesome men went to be forgotten. It lies outside a Bedouin village of the same name, on a road that marks the outer boundary of human habitation in the country's fierce southeastern desert. Beyond the prison, the terrain flattens into a basin of baked mud that stretches to the horizon without a hill or rock or stubble of grass. The ancient sea that once stood here evaporated eons ago, leaving an emptiness like a missing limb, a void so unnatural that it stirs feelings of dread among the few travelers who pause for a look. There's a terrible loneliness, wrote filmmaker David Lean, who shot parts of Lawrence of Arabia on the same mudflats in 1962 and pronounced the place more deserted than any desert I've ever seen. His picture editor, Howard Kent, would describe Al-Jafar as, simply, a warning of what hell is like. It was at this spot that British military overseers chose to build an imposing prison with limestone walls and high watchtowers for detainees regarded as too dangerous for ordinary jails. And it was here, years later, that the Jordanians began the practice of quarantining Palestinian militants and other radicals viewed as threats to the state. Hundreds of men, many of them held without formal charge, languished in stifling, vermin-infested cells where they endured temperature extremes, rancid food, and a catalog of abuses later documented by United Nations investigators. Newly arriving prisoners were routinely beaten until they lost consciousness. Others were flogged with electric cables, burned with lit cigarettes, or hung upside down by means of a stick placed under the knees, a position the guards gleefully called grilled chicken. Over time, the monarchy grew weary of the costs of running a prison so isolated from the country's population and so damaging to its reputation. In 1979, the last of its inmates were transferred to other jails, and Al-Jafar was abandoned to the scorpions and its own ghosts. Years passed, and then, in a sudden shift, the old prison was resurrected. Officials of the Public Security Directorate had grown worried about the behavior of a band of anti-government zealots in the country's central Swaka prison, and in 1998 they decided to isolate the group to prevent the contagion from spreading. The officials reopened one of Al-Jafar's dusty wings and dispatched an army of workers to sweep out corridors and prepare a large cell where all could be housed together. 25 bunk beds were assembled and stacked in cramped rows, and a new door of latticed steel was bolted across the cell's entrance, the room's only opening other than air slits cut into walls at knee level. When the grounds were ready, the department appointed a warden and hired the usual complement of guards, laundrymen, and cooks. The inmates were too few to justify the hiring of a separate prison physician, and so it was that Basil Al-Sabah, a recent medical school graduate assigned by the health department to the local village, was pressed into service as the doctor of record for 50 of the most dangerous men in Jordan. It was an unwelcome assignment for Sabah, a tall 24-year-old with boyish good looks, and he complained bitterly about the posting. Prisons in Jordan were vile places, and this one exceeded all others, at least by reputation. Sabah's anxiety deepened on his very first day as the warden, a middle-aged colonel named Ibrahim, sat him down to review a list of safety precautions. When dealing with inmates such as these, the warden cautioned, it was essential to stay on the other side of the bars at all times, even during medical examinations. And Sabah shouldn't be lulled into thinking that a metal door was protection enough, he warned. These people are very dangerous, Ibrahim said. Even if they're not physically dangerous, they have a way of affecting you. Even I have to be careful that they don't affect me. The warden went on to describe the peculiarities of the new arrivals. From their strange dress, most insisted on wearing an Afghan-style tunic over their jailhouse uniforms because tight-fitting prison trousers were regarded as too revealing, to their ability to make converts out of hardened criminals and even prison employees. At Swaka, so many guards had fallen under their spell that prison officials were forced to limit shifts to 90 minutes in any sector where the inmates might be encountered. As the tour was ending, the warden repeated his warning about the prisoners. There was one inmate, the sect's apparent leader, whose seductive powers were extraordinary, he said. He was the one called Maqdisi, a religious scholar and preacher of considerable gifts, capable of infecting and twisting minds like a Muslim Rasputin. He is very smart, a walking library of Islamic knowledge, Ibrahim said. You will know when you see him. A handsome guy, tall and slim, with light brown hair and blue eyes. Don't be fooled. Moments later, Basil Al-Sabah was being escorted by guards into the prison's interior, past the watchtowers and armed guards, to the wing where the prisoners were kept. It was well past dark, and a dim light shone feebly through the bars of the doorway as the doctor approached. Drawing closer, he could make out the rows of bunks, followed by a jarring first glimpse of the prisoners themselves. 48 inmates sat upright on their bunks or prayer rugs, facing the doorway with rapt attention, like military conscripts awaiting inspection. Each wore the same peculiar uniform, a loose-fitting tunic worn over the standard blue prison shirt and trousers, just as the warden had said. All eyes appeared fixed on a figure near the doorway, and Sabah inched forward to see who it was. At the front of the cell were two men. The first was tall and slender, with scholarly glasses and a tangle of light brown hair protruding from his prayer cap. Sabah guessed that this was the one the warden had called Maqdisi, the cell block's charismatic leader. Yet it was the second man who appeared to command the room's attention. He was darker and shorter, but powerfully built, with a thick neck and shoulders that might have belonged to a wrestler or gymnast. Sabah, now only feet away, noticed an unusual scar on the man's right arm, a jagged gash across a patch of ink-stained skin the color of an old bruise. Around the wound, the flesh showed the pulls and folds of amateur suturing. The owner of the scar studied the rows of bunks for a long moment, then turned to lock his gaze on the visitor. The face was unremarkable, fleshy, with full lips framed by a thin beard. But the eyes were unforgettable, deep-set and nearly black in the low prison light, They conveyed a cold intelligence, alert and probing, but lacking any trace of emotion. Neither welcoming nor hostile, his look was that of a snake studying the fat young mouse that had just dropped into his cage. At last, the warden spoke. He mumbled words of introduction for the new doctor and then declared the start of clinic hours. All prisoners with medical complaints can step forward to be examined, he said. Sabah edged closer to the door to await the inevitable rush. He had prepared for the moment and had brought along a supply of pills and salves to treat the rashes, minor wounds, allergies, and gastric ailments common to men living in close confinement. But, to his surprise, no one stirred. The inmates sat motionless, waiting for a sign from the scarred man, who at last turned his gaze on an inmate seated on a bed near the front of the cell. When he gave a slight nod, the seated prisoner stood and walked to the doorway without a sound. He nodded a second time and a third, and one by one, inmates took their place in line in front of the doctor. Five men, and only five, were summoned, and still the man with the scar had not uttered a word. He turned to the doctor with the same reptilian stare, the look of a man who possessed, even in Jordan's harshest prison, absolute control. Sabah felt an uneasiness, like a tremor welling up from somewhere deep in the foundation of the old fortress. What kind of person, he wondered, can command with only his eyes? Over the following days, the doctor scoured files for insights into his new patients and why prison officials had come to fear them. The group's core, he learned, consisted of about 24 men who had been members of radical Islamic sects that sprang up in Jordan in the early 1990s. With the exception of the leader, Abu Muhammad al-Maqdisi, a firebrand preacher known for penning screeds against Arab leaders, their individual histories were unimpressive. Some had been street thugs who had gotten religion and found acceptance and purpose among the zealots. Others had been part of the Arab volunteer army that had fought against the Soviets in Afghanistan in the 1980s. Back home in safe, stable Jordan, these men had been drawn to organizations that offered a way to relive the glories of the Afghan campaign through perpetual holy war against the enemies of Islam. Their efforts at jihad in Jordan had been anything but glorious. The leaders of Maqdisi's small band had been arrested before they could carry out their first operation, a planned attack on an Israeli border post. The other group's targets had consisted of small-time symbols of Western corruption, from liquor stores to video shops and pornographic movie houses. One of the early attempts at a bombing had been a spectacular failure. A member of the group had volunteered to plant explosives inside a local adult cinema called the Sulwa. After a few minutes in the theater, the would-be assailant had become so engrossed in the film that he forgot about his bomb. As he sat, glued to the screen, the device detonated under his feet. No patrons were hurt, but the bomber lost both his legs. 6 years later, the double amputee was among Sabah's charges at Al-Jafar prison. The doctor had noticed him on his first visit, propped up on his bunk, his pant legs neatly pinned at the knee. By now, nearly all the men had been locked up for 4 years or more. But if prison was meant to break the jihadists and weaken their cause, the attempt was an utter failure. Confined mostly in the same communal cells, the men had been bound together by their privations and by the daily struggle to persevere as religious purists among drug dealers, thieves, and killers. They shared a common creed, an austere brand of Islam invented by Maqdisi and inculcated during endless weeks of confinement. They also possessed an uncommon discipline. The group behaved as a military unit, with clear chains of authority and unquestioned obedience to Mokhtisi's hand-picked enforcer, the scarred, thick-chested man who had made such an impression during Sabah's first visit to the prison. Mokhtisi told the men what to think, but his number two controlled everything else. How the men spoke and dressed, which books they read, and which television shows they watched, whether they accepted or resisted prison dictates, when and how they fought. The man's given name was Ahmad Fadil al-Kalele, but he preferred to be called al-Gharib, or the Stranger, a handle he had picked up during his days as a fighter in the Afghan Civil War. Some, however, were already calling him the one from Zarqa, the tough industrial town in northern Jordan where he grew up. The phrase in Arabic is al-Zarqawi. Sabah was able to observe both leaders up close. The Mokhtisi he saw was mild and agreeable, more amiable professor than beguiling mystic. At just shy of 40, he had the weary air of an intellectual who felt he deserved better company than the few dozen backward men who shared his cell. He freely dispensed religious advice and the occasional fatwa, or religious ruling, but he preferred spending his time in solitary pursuits, writing essays and reading the Quran. On the printed page, Mokhtisi was fearless. He gained renown throughout the Muslim world for inflammatory books with titles such as Democracy is a Religion, in which he denounced secular Arab regimes as anti-Islamic and called for their destruction. His work eventually gained such resonance among Islamists that a Pentagon Commission study in 2006 would call him the most important new thinker in the jihadi intellectual universe. Previous Islamist ideologues also had criticized leaders of the Arab world as corrupt and unfaithful to the religion. The same themes appeared in the writings of Sayyid Qutb, the influential Egyptian author whose works inspired the founders of Al-Qaeda. But in Mokhtisi's view, each Muslim bore a personal obligation to act when confronted with evidence of official heresy. It wasn't enough for the faithful simply to denounce corrupt rulers. They were compelled by Allah to slaughter them. His radical conclusion was that the leaders were infidels and Muslims should kill them, said Hassan Abu Haniya, a Jordanian writer and intellectual who was friendly with Mokhtisi during the years when his ideas were beginning to congeal. The killing was the turning point. It was a message that resonated with Muslims who felt that the regimes were stupid and had allowed foreigners to occupy Arab lands. For these people, Mokhtisi was not only validating their views, but telling them they were obliged to do something about it. Oddly enough, the man who called so bluntly for confronting Islam's enemies tended to shy away from conflict. As Sabah observed, whenever interrogators and agents of the intelligence services visited the prison, he would greet them politely and ask about their families, to the dismay of other inmates who had suffered at the hands of the same men. He would patiently explain to guards and prison officers why they and their government were heretics, buttressing his arguments with quotes from the Quran. But he would often retreat when challenged, allowing that less severe interpretations of scripture could also be valid. "You can be a member of parliament and still be a good Muslim," he told Sabah one day, offering a nuance that seemed to contradict his central thesis about the evils of non-theocratic governance. "If someone is elected because he wants to serve the people, that's being a good Muslim. But if he believes in democracy, if he believes in the rules made by men, he is an infidel." Mokhtisi seemed fond of the young physician who, though secular, was the only other person at Al-Jafar with an advanced degree. Their relationship took a turn one day when the youngest of Mokhtisi's wives fell ill during a visit to the desert prison, The woman suffered from unusual menstrual bleeding, and Sabah arranged to see her at his private clinic in the village. The gesture might have risked offense. Many ultra-conservative Muslim men refused to allow their wives to be seen by male doctors. But Maqdisi seemed genuinely grateful. After that day, the physician's visits to the cell block were greeted with wide grins. But politeness and intellect are poor instruments for commanding men in such a hard place as Al-Jafar. Maqdisi needed an enforcer. In Zarqawi, he had found the perfect helper. A man with the distinction of being at once slavishly devoted and utterly ruthless. "He is very tough," Maqdisi would say admiringly, referring to his number two. "And he is a Jordanian's Jordanian, a man of the tribe." Their personalities could hardly have been more different. Zarqawi had no capacity for warmth or nuance. The man with the scar did not smile. He did not return greetings from prison employees or engage in their small talk. When he spoke at all, it was with the street slang of a high school dropout who had grown up as a brawler and petty criminal in one of Zarqa's toughest neighborhoods. His gruffness and refusal to conform to convention had marked him as a troublemaker since boyhood. They also helped burnish the legend that was already beginning to cement around Zarqawi in his 33rd year. Whereas Maqdisi preferred the ethereal world of books and ideas, Zarqawi was purely a physical being, with a compact, muscular frame that he chiseled through weightlifting, using buckets of stones as barbells. The whispered stories of his criminal past, the stabbings and beatings, the pimping and drug dealing, made him seem dangerous and unpredictable, a man of action, capable of anything. He had fought bravely, even recklessly, in Afghanistan, and his reputation for impulsive violence had followed him into prison. He habitually defied authorities in the first of the jails where he and the others were confined, and he brutalized and humiliated inmates who crossed him, sometimes with fists or crude weapons, and sometimes, it was widely said, sexually. Once, in a rage, he had grabbed a prison guard by his uniform collar and suspended him from a coat hook. Another time, he instigated a violent protest by inmates armed with crude clubs and swords fashioned from bed frames. "We have come to die," the prisoners had screamed. And some surely would have, except for the timely intervention of a warden who acceded to many of the jihadists' demands. Under Maqdisi's tutelage, Zarqawi's attacks subsided, but the violent energy simply shifted form. Zarqawi began memorizing the Quran, spending hour after hour reading or staring blankly with the open volume in his lap. His diffuse rage took on a focus, a fierce, single-minded hatred for perceived enemies of Allah. The list started with Jordan's monarch, King Hussein, whom Zarqawi saw as the illegitimate leader of an artificial country, responsible for the unspeakable crime of making peace with Israel. It also included servants of the regime, the guards, the soldiers, the politicians, the bureaucrats, and countless others who profited from the current system. Even prison inmates he denounced as kafirs, or disbelievers. To Muslims, the term is no mere epithet. If used in a fatwa, it implies that the person has lost the protection of Islamic law and can be killed with impunity. Within the prison, the guards began referring to Zarqawi and his closest followers as al-Takfiris, the excommunicators. At the same time, Zarqawi began taking a stronger hand as a leader and an enforcer among the Islamist prisoners. He demanded the absolute obedience of the men, and he berated them whenever they skipped prayers or watched television news shows anchored by women who were not veiled. Despite his harsh manner, he won admirers because of his fearless defiance of prison authority. When official visitors came to Al-Jafar, Zarqawi would often ignore them and refuse even to acknowledge their greetings, and he would order his men to do the same. One day, after Jordan agreed to open its prisons to inspections from human rights groups, a senior Interior Ministry official arrived at Al-Jafar to check on conditions and implore the inmates not to say anything negative to the foreigners. The Islamists refused to answer his questions or even look at him. The exasperated official first scolded the men, then tried to cajole them into cooperating with suggestions that their sentences could be reduced. "God willing, King Hussein will pardon you," he said. Zarqawi stood suddenly and jabbed a finger just inches from the bureaucrat's nose. "This master is not our master," he snarled. "Ours is Allah Almighty." The visitor snapped. "I swear to God, you will not leave," he shouted. "You will stay in this prison." "By Allah," Zarqawi replied coldly, "we will come out, forcibly, if God wills." There was another side to Zarqawi. Sabah would catch occasional glimpses of it during his prison visits. It was jarringly incongruous with Zarqawi's usual behavior, as though he suffered from a split personality. Everyone at Al-Jafar knew how Zarqawi worshipped his mother, how he became like a little boy whenever she visited. He would prepare for days, scrubbing his clothes in the sink and tidying up his corner of the cell. Some inmates knew about his love letters to her and to his sisters. Scarcely a word was mentioned about Zarqawi's wife, Intisar, or their two young children. But to his mother and sisters, he wrote gushing notes adorned with poems and hand-drawn flowers in the margins. "Oh, sister, how much you have suffered on account of my imprisonment for the sake of my religion," he wrote to Qadama in one carefully scrawled note with alternating blue and red ink. He closed with a poem. "I wrote you a letter, oh, my sister, which I made of my soul's desire. The first thing I write is the fire of my heart, and the second is my love and longing." The other objects of Zarqawi's exaggerated attentions were the sick and injured among his men. When any of the Islamists fell ill, he put himself in the role of heroic caregiver, giving up his own blankets and rations to ensure their comfort. He hovered over Sabah and a second doctor who joined the prison staff, hectoring them whenever he felt his men were being shortchanged. "Where's the medicine you promised for this one?" he would demand, according to Sabah's recollection. Once, when one of the inmates left Al-Jafar for a few days of hospital therapy, he fretted like a nervous parent, nagging Sabah for news about the man's condition. Sabah was particularly struck by the tenderness Zarqawi displayed toward the most fragile of the inmates, the double amputee named Aid Jahalin, the unlucky bomber who flubbed the attack on the pornographic cinema. Jahalin, who suffered from a psychological disorder in addition to his physical disfigurement, had always bunked with the other Islamist inmates in spite of extreme disabilities. Zarqawi appointed himself as the man's personal valet and assisted him with his bathing, changing, and feeding. Most days, he would simply scoop up the legless man in his arms and carry him to the toilet. Sabah suspected that the daily ritual had as much to do with Zarqawi's peculiar sense of propriety as with genuine compassion for his comrade. Under the Islamists' strict moral code, exposing the man's naked body to others would constitute both a humiliation and a sin. One evening, while Sabah was visiting the cell, Jahalin suffered one of his occasional meltdowns, a screaming fit that usually required treatment with antipsychotic drugs. Sabah grabbed a syringe and was preparing to administer the shot when Zarqawi stepped forward to block him. Without a word, Zarqawi took a blanket from one of the beds and draped it over Jahalin's lower body. He held the blanket in place with one hand, and with the other he tugged at the elastic waistband of the disabled man's trousers exposing a narrow crescent of skin. Then he motioned to the doctor. "Just make sure it's in the right spot," he commanded. Sabah felt for Jahaleen's pelvic bone through his clothes and, satisfied, pushed the needle into the pale flesh. When it was done and Jahaleen was resting quietly, Sabah looked up to find Zarqawi watching him with a look of satisfaction. There was something different in the reptilian eyes, a quality that the doctor had not noticed before. He thought it might have been the stirrings of a smile. The arrival of winter in 1998 brought freezing temperatures and scores of newcomers, as prison officials sought to relieve overcrowding elsewhere in the system. The Islamists remained cloistered together, as always, but now subtle cracks were beginning to show. Some of the jihadists were openly suggesting that Zarqawi should be the leader, replacing Maqdisi, whose professorial demeanor had begun to grate on some members of the group. Zarqawi made no move against his mentor, but the feelings of many inmates were quite clear. Maqdisi's nuanced theological arguments were lost on the high school dropouts and petty criminals who made up much of the group. These men preferred someone with tough guy credentials, like Zarqawi, a brawler who talked plainly and refused to compromise. As he himself admitted, Maqdisi was no warrior. Even while living in Arab training camps in Afghanistan, he had given up on learning how to use a gun. He was not a fighter who lived between the bullets, the missiles, and the tanks, even for a day, one of the Afghan veterans later explained. Zarqawi clearly liked being in charge, and he gradually took on a still more dominant role with his mentor's blessing, leaving Maqdisi to oversee spiritual matters. For the first time, important people outside prison were beginning to hear his name. Maqdisi had many admirers within the Islamist movement's diaspora, from London to the Palestinian cities of the West Bank, and some of them were men with resources and extensive connections throughout the Middle East, North Africa, and Europe. Now they were learning through Maqdisi about his impressive assistant, an Afghan veteran of unusual courage and natural leadership ability. Sabah, meanwhile, found himself working more frequently with Zarqawi, and their interactions became increasingly cordial, if not exactly warm. One evening, as Sabah was making his rounds, Zarqawi pulled the doctor aside to make a request. It was the first time the man had asked for anything on his own behalf. "I think I have high blood sugar," he began. "My mother has diabetes, so maybe it's in the family. Can you check?" Sabah was happy to oblige, but it was complicated, he said. The test could not be performed in the prison. The risk of infection was too high to draw blood in Al-Jafar's filthy, rodent-infested cells. So Zarqawi would have to be brought to the doctor's private clinic in the village. There was another complication. Obtaining the official approvals needed to allow such a dangerous inmate to leave Al-Jafar. As expected, the warden protested vigorously. What if it was a ruse to help Zarqawi escape? What if his allies were waiting in ambush in the town? But eventually, Ibrahim relented, and arrangements were made for the armed escort that would deliver the prisoner to the village clinic and back again. On the day of the test, Sabah decided to wait at the village clinic for his patient to show up. It was well after dark when a convoy of 10 vehicles arrived, with a complement of dozens of guards armed with assault rifles. It was the biggest military escort Sabah had ever seen, and he wondered at first if someone from the royal court had decided to call on the village. Instead, a solitary prisoner stumbled out of one of the vans and then disappeared again inside a moving cocoon of armed men. Zarqawi was led into the doctor's office in his prison garb, still wearing his handcuffs. "Please take those off," Sabah ordered, gesturing to the metal bracelets. "Sir, the man is dangerous," one of the escorts protested. "You have 50 soldiers watching his every move," the doctor replied, I insist that the cuffs be taken off. Having succeeded in freeing Zarqawi's arms, Sabah proceeded with his examination. He began to roll up one of the prisoner's shirt sleeves to draw a blood sample, but was stopped again, this time by Zarqawi. "I'm sorry," the inmate apologized. Zarqawi lowered the sleeve back to its position before the doctor had touched it. Then he rolled it back up again, without help. Sabah had tripped on another of Zarqawi's indecipherable codes on the touching of naked flesh. As the blood was being drawn, Sabah worked up the courage to ask, finally, about the nature of the mysterious scar on Zarqawi's arm. "It was a tattoo, an anchor," he replied. "What happened?" Zarqawi began to recount how he had gotten the tattoo at age 16, at a time when, as he put it, "I wasn't very Islamic-minded." After he joined the jihadist movement, his tattoo became an embarrassment. He tried scrubbing it off in various ways, including with bleach. The skin turned an angry red, but the tattoo would not budge. Finally, he turned to one of his Zarqa relatives, who was visiting the prison with a razor hidden in his clothes. As Zarqawi sat, the kinsman cut two elliptical lines around the tattoo. He then sliced away the upper layers of skin. When the tattoo was mostly gone, he closed the wound with crude stitches. Sabah's face betrayed his horror at the story, but Zarqawi just shrugged, as though the act of hacking off an offending piece of flesh were as natural as squashing a cockroach. Islam, his brand of Islam, required it. This was an indisputable fact. The rest was a simple act of will. "Tattoos," he explained impassively, "are haram, forbidden." Sabah finished his exam, and Zarqawi, who showed no signs of physical disease, returned to prison with his escorts. The doctor remained behind to ponder in his small clinic by the road on the edge of a dead lake, dwarfed by the vastly larger Arabian desert just beyond it. 70 years earlier, an Islamic army had traversed the same road, riding north on horses and camels with the intention of wiping out the country known as Jordan in the name of Allah. These Bedouin raiders, who called themselves Ikhwan, or brothers, had been armed and trained by Saudi Arabia's first monarch, Ibn Saud, to help him defeat his political rivals. But the Ikhwan had ambitions beyond the Arabian Peninsula. Bloodthirsty fanatics who regarded all Western inventions and practices as works of the devil, they saw themselves as divinely appointed to purify the region by slaughtering all who allied with foreigners or deviated from their narrow vision of Islam. From the harsh wastelands of the interior, they thundered into the newly formed countries of Jordan and Iraq in the early 1920s with the intention of toppling governments and creating a unified Islamic theocracy, or caliphate, spanning all of the Middle East. They hacked and slashed their way through entire villages that stood in their path, slitting the throats of every male survivor to ensure that all traces of Western modernity were wiped out. Despite vain attempts by the Saudi monarch to control them, an Ikhwan army of about 1,500 advanced to within 10 miles of Amman, the Jordanian capital, before finally being stopped. British warplanes spotted the approaching column and cut them down with machine guns until all but about 100 of the raiders were dead. Small bands of militants continued to control parts of the Saudi interior at least until the 1950s, menacing and sometimes killing outsiders who wandered near their villages. Eventually they vanished, yet the fierce hatreds that animated the Ikhwan never went away. The unwavering intolerance, the embrace of an extreme and pitilessly violent form of Islam as a kind of cleansing fire, these would find acceptance into the late 20th century and beyond, from isolated villages in the peninsula's interior to the oil-rich cities of the Gulf Coast, and from the rugged hills of eastern Afghanistan to the crowded cells of an infamous Jordanian prison. At Al Jafar, the contagion was contained within thick prison walls, at least for a time. Under the sentence handed down by the judge in Amman, Zarqawi's confinement was to continue for another 10 years, until 2009, when the muscular and vital young man would be entering middle age. Yet, as Sabah well knew, prison terms in Jordan were rarely what they seemed on paper. A sentence could be drastically shortened because of a change in government or a perceived need to curry favor with a religious party or tribe. If that happened, Zarqawi could find himself, and perhaps his army of followers, suddenly free.